Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on. Harriet Rigney, Mr. Jordan's widow and chief editor, has appointed noted author Brandon Sanderson to complete the final novel entitled A Memory of Light.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. I'm happy to be here again, happy that you're here, and also with us this week we have Spencer. Hi, Spencer.
Hey, everybody. Nice to be back.
Before we begin this week's podcast, I think everyone here at the Fourth Age would just like to take a moment and raise a glass in salute to Robert Jordan on this anniversary, the second anniversary of his passing.
He's never far from our thoughts and very much missed.
So this week's podcast will begin a short-run series of podcasts, which was a request by Omri, who says, maybe before the Gathering Storm comes out, you guys do a kind of recap of the important stuff that happened in Knife of Dreams. I don't mean a simple storyline, though you could do that too, and of course we will. But the things that we little people didn't notice or didn't give enough significance to. Well, Omri, we all thought that that was an actually wonderful idea. So this podcast is going to begin our recap of Knife of Dreams.
Message call for you, sir.
Well, what does it say, Patsy?
It says here that the Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series, and that this podcast may contain spoilers.
Right then, butcher the cow, we'll have some steak.
Beginning with the prologue, Embers Falling on Dry Grass.
And that prologue starts out with the memorable phrase, "The sweetness of victory and the bitterness of defeat are alike a knife of dreams."
The prologue begins when along a road in Amadisia, accompanied by Trom, Dane Bornhold, and Jarrett Byer, going to a manor house which once belonged to King Aelrun, but who the Seanchan to Aemond Valda, the current Lord Captain Commander of the White Cloaks. Galad has the intent to challenge Aemond Valda a trial by light, which is single combat between two combatants, in order to assert that Valda has assaulted and killed Morghais. Galad, of course, at this point does not know that Morghais is, but from everything he's been able to piece together, he realizes that Valda is to blame for this. They arrive at the manor, where there are about 50 regular Children of the Light and half a dozen questioners, led by Rodham Asunua. Asunua objects to Galad's request made through Trom, but allows for trial by light to continue anyway. Valda, a blade master, and Galad fight, and Galad prevails, killing Valda. The questioners leave just as Galad makes his final cut in order to rally the other Lord's Captain to arrest Galad for the murder of Valda, but the Children of the Light who remained behind throw their support behind Galad, and he tells them that in order to march toward Tarmon Gaiden, they may have to fight with Aes Sedai and Ashaman, a number of whom a Kyrianan named Dorialin agrees that they can agree to fight the Aes Sedai, or fight with Aes Sedai and Ashaman if it means opposing the Seanchan, who have taken over, even though they are tentative allies with the White Cloaks. This group of White Cloaks have now acclaimed that since trial by combat with the Lord Captain Commander resulted in the death of the Lord Captain Commander, that Gala is now the new Lord Captain Commander.
Then we switch to Royal Ithralda. It is near dawn, and he's leading 100 Domani and 300 Terrabonners. Dragonsworn, Torne Lanathit leads 200 Terrabonners to assault a village near Sarani in Terrabon. There's a Shanchan camp right next to the village. The Dragonsworn come up and kind of harass the camp, which leads the Shanchan armies out to confront them. And then Ithralde, with his forces, loose volley upon volley of arrows against them to kill the Shanchan forces, and he also scares off several hundred, who the Dragonsworn, led by Lanathit, follow. Ithralde then sets fire to all the warehouses and such in the camp, and makes sure to warn the villagers who are living right next door that they need to get out, since fire can easily spread into the village. He has set up nearly 20,000 men all over Terrabon in similar raids, and he means to work his way back north and regather his men. He expects the Shanchan to fall in fury. They will fall into the trap he has set in Almuth Plain. If they see the trap, he even has a backup plan, and a backup to the plan, and a backup to the backup to the backup plan.
The next point of view that we come to is that of the High Lady Siroth Sabel Meldaroth, and we find her in Ebudar as dawn is nearing. She can't sleep. She's just frantic, wondering if Tuon is alive or dead, because it's been 17 days, and she believes that the escape of the Athan Mier Domani and the death of Queen Tylan mean that Tuon is dead and that someone is trying to disrupt the return. Two of her own Soldam, Rena and Seda, actually disappeared at the same time. We find also that Igan and Tamaroth stole a pair of Domani and also disappeared at the same time as well. Now, Suroth is thinking that if Tuon is indeed dead, she will have to apologize to the Empress, which is a long and apparently very painful process. And she believes that if that happens, she will certainly kill herself before ever reaching Shandar. And she still has some hope, but Tuon's Dursaldam left 9 days ago with all of her Soldam and Domani. So Captain Musenji left at the same time with many of his men, and she worries that someone may suspect that she is Athan Hadar, a dark friend. Leandrin enters into her chambers dressed as a duck o' veil, and her Lopar, Almandaragol, prepares to defend her. Leandrin had killed her Sojin Alwyn, and Leandrin professes her loyalty by citing how she had accomplished that. And Leandrin is bringing a message from an officer of Captain General Galgan to summon Suroth, and Suroth thinks that it's time to have a Soldam call her Leandrin because she's just driving her crazy. And so she decides that she's going to send Elbar to find another dark friend. Elbar is one of her minions. She then sends Leandrin to Rosala for a beating and goes into her anteroom where Banner General Mikhail Najira is awaiting her. He escorts her through the palace where Beslan, Tylan's son, is now king. Captain General Lunal Galgan's ancestors date back to Luther Pendrag, but Suroth isn't terribly impressed about that. He tells from Lieutenant General Turon of dozens of raids in Terrabon and that Rodal Ithralde was behind him. She then orders them to bring her Ithralde's head. Semirag appears to her masked in fire. Semirag then offers to make Suroth empress. This terrifies Suroth, but Semirag tells her that she had killed Empress Radanan, Tuon's mother, and all of the imperial family is also dead. Then Shandar is in chaos, there's civil war from the Aldar Mountains to Salaking. She laughs and says, "Let the Lord of Chaos rule," which Suroth does not understand. But she's horrified that even one of the chosen, who the Shanchan called Dekansion, the chosen ones, could actually reach into the imperial family to kill them. Shemirag orders Suroth to put all of her efforts into killing Tuon and expanding the rumor that Tuon is an impostor. Suroth agrees. She will send Elbar, her loyal minion, with thousands of men to kill Tuon.
We then switch over to Pavara. Pavara and Javindra are meeting with Sutsama Roth, the Red Aj highest, in her apartments. The highest confirms reports of the disaster at Dumai's Wells and the subsequent binding of sisters to Randolph Thor. During this conversation, Sutsama orders Pavara to go ahead with the plan to ally themselves and bond Ashaman as warders, and orders Pavara to see to finding sisters who will accept this duty. After that meeting, Pavara goes and meets with Yukiri. Yukiri reports that she has broken Maris Thornhill, and that they have learned that a meeting of the Black Aja's Supreme Council is that night. Vivara suggests that they gather their force and strike en masse, but Yukiri manages to convince her that it is a bad idea. They are joined by Cien. The White Aja has learned of the disasters from the Black Tower and of Dumai's Wells. She also reports that she has met with Elida, and Elida has finally made the original mission clear to her, which was not, in fact, to hunt the Black Aja, but, in fact, to find treason in Alvieran. As a result, they are no longer certain that Elida is not Black Aja herself.
Then we switch over to Alvieran's point of view. She has received a secret message that she finds behind a tapestry, and she returns to her quarters. She is still overwhelmed by her experience with Shedar Haran, who she believes is the Great Lord. She passes several people on the way, and as she gets into the White Aja quarters, everyone there is ashamed of her, they are mad at her, glaring at her, there's even some rude comments made towards her because she has been demoted from Keeper, and she has to go every morning for penances with Sylvana. It mentions that Catherine has spread the news of Dumai's Wells through the Black Aja, and so to spread it throughout the tower. And in her room, she decodes the messages, the message that she receives, and two others that she had gotten. One reports that Talene has left the White Tower. She had been summoned to a Supreme Council meeting, and she had run away from that. Alvieran is now certain that there is something between her and Yukiri and Dosin, but she is afraid to call Masana. She writes orders to find Talene and to keep a close watch on Yukiri and Dosin.
In the next part of the prologue, we come to Galena Kazban's point of view. Galena is wearing Gaishane white and riding her horse Swift outside of the Shido camp, making plans to repay Elida. She's still owned by Thrava, totally under her thumb. She cannot channel without permission, and Savanna almost never lets her channel. Her goal is to get the oath rod that Thavara has so that she can remove the oaths. Gaul and Fagerniel kidnap her and take her to Perrin's encampment. She threatens that Savanna and Thrava will punish them, but they bring her through to a gateway to Perrin anyway. Galena recognizes Barilane. From Dumai's Well, she realizes that Niald and the other black-coated men are a shaman and nearly panics. Despite her clothes, she claims that she is on Aes Sedai business that they can't possibly understand, and they need to just leave her alone. She claims that she has Fael and Aleandra under her protection in the Sea of Maldon. She also lies and gives her name as Elise. Barilane then offers to let her speak with Masuri, Sakawa, Sinead Trigan, and Anura Larison, the Aes Sedai that are with Perrin, but Galena declines, probably because they could unmask her in some way. And Perrin then has her verify the accuracy of the maps that he has of Maldon and the surrounding Shido camp. She asks him to hold off his attack for a week so that she can conclude her affairs, but he will not commit and asks her about the Rise Ones drinking only water. He then asks her to warn Fael to go to Lady Chiron's fortress at the north end of the city and hide when she hears wolves howling during the day. Galena lies and says that she will do that. A lean serving woman with a gray bun enters to light lamps. Isn't that Linny? Anyway, after retrieving her horse, Neil takes her back to the Shido camp, but she's still very late and Rava punishes her grievously. She still plans to get the oath rod, kill Fael and her friends, and hopefully escape. The next point of view is Egwene Alvier's, and Egwene awakes riding in the carriage to Tarvalen from North Harbor to the White Tower, and she's in the company of five Aes Sedai who have taken her from where she was captured after turning the harbor chain into Coendiar, and the Aes Sedai that are with her are Katarina Rudin and Barasine of the Red Aja, Falana of the Brown, Pritala Nurbaijan of the Yellow, Risha Terakuna of the Gray. The sisters of the different Ajas are nearly at each other's throat, and they make that very apparent on that ride. Jala and Nirim went ahead to report to Elida. Egwene's been given fork root, and she tries to remember what Nynaeve told her about it. She then wonders if Romanda or Lelaine will be raised Amarlin's seat after her kidnapping. The Aes Sedai that are with her wonder what she did to the harbor chain, and she tells them that she converted it to Coendiar. After they reach the White Tower and disembark, they run into Nicola Treehill in Novice White, waiting at the back entrance. She tells them that Elida wants Egwene sent to Sylviana, the new mistress of novices. Nicola apologizes to Egwene for running away and says that Arena is with her. Katarine and Barasine escort Egwene into the White Tower. Inside, they went into Malari, who was with Zana, Arabius, and Dasala at South Harbor, and those were the Aes Sedai that had captured Leon after she converted half the chain in her heart in South Harbor to Quendiar. Catarine and Barristan take her to Sylviana Brehon, who is the mistress of novices. Elida has reduced Egwene to novice, but otherwise has not yet punished her, blaming everything on the rebel leaders. Sylviana says that Sheriam Bayanar was too lenient with the novices, but that she's not going to be that way. Egwene then tells her that she is a dreamer and warns her about the coming Shanshan attack, which she had dreamed. Catarine and Barristan then escort her to the novice quarters, where she goes to sleep and enters Teleran Riad, where she warns Siwan about what happened to them, and she explains that she's going to start working on disrupting the White Tower from within.
We'd like to thank Encyclopedia Watt for providing this general summary of what happened during the prologue. We will continue to use them as we continue our recap. You can find them online at www.encyclopedia-watt.org.
And we want to thank Bob Klutz for putting together this fabulous resource website. It's just amazing. If you can't find it there, maybe it doesn't even exist.
So as I was reading through the prologue, I made a number of notes as things occurred to me. And this is what we are going to use to fuel our own more in-depth recap of the things that happened that may have gotten missed. The first and foremost, when Galad enters in and the challenge by light is first made, Asunawa makes some excuses against actually doing trial by light. He basically claims, oh, it's not been used in years, it's outdated, and just give the name of the person who wronged you over to me, and we'll deal with him. I find it really interesting because Asunawa was in collusion with Valda during that particular time, even though they really don't like each other. And I kind of have to wonder if foreknowledge of Galad's character would lead Asunawa to assume that this was coming in advance, which is why he's trying to forestall it, or forestall trial by combat. It seems a little weird that he just kind of makes this excuse of, oh, just give it to us and that we'll deal with the problem. And it really seems like he's kind of hedging against taking place in combat, which is interesting, even though he is not yet aware that Valda is the one who is being accused.
But do you think he suspects that? And possibly he knows that Eamon Valla had actually taken advantage of Morghaz and abused her?
Oh, I'm fully certain he knew about it, because during some of their earlier conversations, I want to say that Morghaz, when talking to Asunawa, you know, he kind of basically said, oh, well, you know, I know what's going on and that, but sooner or later they'll give you to me instead.
I confess I don't remember that, but then that just could just be me. As I've said many times, my memory has more holes than maths and nothing to fill it with.
And once Galad found out about it, it is very obvious to me that Galad isn't just doing the right thing. What really struck me about his point of view in this prologue was how passionate Galad actually was. Usually when we saw him, he was kind of, you know, to coin a phrase from, you know, role-playing games, and that he was a cookie-cutter paladin. You know, I will do what is right, you know, no matter what the consequences. And in this scene, you get passages like right after Valda, he meets Valda in the middle of the space so that they could possibly exchange words and settle it, which, of course, both contestants knew wasn't going to happen. During that exchange, Valda tells him, I want one thing straight in your mind before I kill you, though. The wench was hale when last I saw her, and if she's dead, now I'll regret it. That smile deepened, both in humor and disdain. She was the best ride I ever had, and I hope to ride her again one day. Red-hot fury fountained inside Galad, but with an effort he managed to turn his back on Valda and walk away, already feeding his rage into an imagined flame, as his two teachers had once taught him. And it's just that it's not just that she's a stepmother. I mean, Galad really does see Morghese as a surrogate mother, and he is so thoroughly livid over even just the implication of the sexual assault that, you know, he is absolutely determined that even if it costs him his own life, Valda has to die. And that sort of extreme passion fitting in with the fact that that Galad is only capable of doing what is right in his mind just really made for a powerful scene to me.
Yeah, there was probably no crime imaginable that would have been any more calculated to inflame and offend Galad's sense of honor. And then to have it happen, I think he would have felt nearly that outraged had that happened to any woman, but then to have it happen to his stepmother, whom he obviously had feelings for, just put the icing on the cake. There was no way that he could not avenge that stain on Morghese's honor, and he did it very well.
The other thing that was kind of noticeable within this particular portion is yet another example of how Dane Bornhold was thoroughly destroyed by his father's death. You kind of see that he's not a very good White Cloak. Galad seems to express more knowledge of the children than Dane, despite the fact that Dane's been in the Children of Light for far more years.
Dane's kind of like a Navy brat, you know, he grew up with the White Cloaks pretty much.
Yeah, and yet at the same time, it's Galad's only been within the White Cloaks for a few months, really. And already he understands their laws and the ideas behind them better than Dane ever possibly could.
Well, I believe that's because it's Galad's nature. His whole core personality and the structure of his nature and his ethical code and everything are almost 100% analogous to the original foundation of the White Cloaks in the beginning. I think, you know, they've sort of been corrupted and turned from their initial path, but I mean, he was absolutely going to fit right in with the original code. So, I mean, it isn't even something he had to learn. It's not even second nature to him. It is his nature, his first nature. So I think it was really easy for him to become a child of the light, where it's probably a struggle for most men. But Galad is very unusual, you know, in, like you say, he's kind of a cookie-cutter paladin. He just is that way, and there is nothing going to change him, sort of some catastrophic event in his life to cause him to fall to the dark side or something like that. I can't even imagine what would do it.
Yeah. Now, the trial by light is a standard format trial by combat. You can look, you can see it in other fiction, you can see it in historical evidence, and it's basically, it evolves out of an idea that the better warrior is correct. And yet, Galad, at this point, is not a blade master, where Valda is. So, Valda, of course, knowing that the idea that it's the better warrior is the one who's going to win, is going to be proven right, is confident that he's going to win. And that's why he allows the trial by combat. Yeah, but Galad does actually end up winning. And I know that Galad is good, but when you look at through the course of the fight, Galad takes many more wounds than Valda does. And I kind of just have to wonder if maybe that concept that the person who is correct in the light, you know, the creator's favored person, will prevail. And I'm not wondering if maybe the creator doesn't directly interfere, but maybe we might actually see a kind of taking of hand by a slightly higher and more favored power.
I have two points to make about that. I think that the only reason that Galad does not have the official title of Blade Master is because of the, during Elida's coup in the White Tower, the younglings basically killed their teachers and took off to become the younglings. And so his formal education ceased, but I think he was probably fairly close to being a blade master at that point in time and probably would have passed the tests soon had that not happened. But what happened to him was almost exactly what happened to the three girls. They left the White Tower in the middle of their training, but they didn't stop learning, and I think that's the same thing that happened to Galad. And the second point was, Galad does take a lot of wounds in that, but at one point in time, he takes a number of the wounds because he's using a ploy. He's breathing heavily through his mouth, and he's using the same attack over and over, and slowing down slightly on purpose to try and draw Valda, so that Valda will come in and make a fatal mistake, which he does, thinking he's going in for the kill, and Galad is not nearly as tired and weakened as he's been pretending, and he cuts him open. So I think that was, you know, he took the damage in order to win the fight, and I think that a lot of that was not necessarily that he wasn't good enough to beat a blade master, but that he was just clever enough to know that that was one of the ways that he could do it, because I think they were fairly evenly matched apart from that.
No, I definitely agree that Galad was good enough to be a blade master. I was under the impression that Galad had actually left before the tower was split, because he had gone off. I know he'd been studying the book, but I thought he had left prior to that, and that Gawain was the only one left when the younglings formed up. Now, I might be wrong about that.
That might be. They might have sent him off to command somewhere. I know, Morghais, that he was, you know, on command somewhere with some troops. So you may be right about that, but I had rather thought that I'd have to go back and look that up to see if they were both at the White Tower during the coup. You may be right. Probably Galad had been moved on by that time. But that doesn't mean that, you know, he still might not have been ready to test for a blade master, but with all the, you know, turbulence and politics and everything, it just hadn't quite happened yet. I'm not sure about the creator taking a hand, because it's kind of been made pretty clear that the creator doesn't really take much of a direct hand, but that, again, you can't rule out anything, really.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that the creator took a direct hand, but the given reason for any sort of trial by combat is that the person who is correct, you know, that the light will illuminate the one who is correct. And in this case, it actually did. And it just seems to me that there's a little more to that than just two guys walk in and the guy who was better with the sword ended up winning. But he also coincidentally happened to also be the one who was right.
Well, my feelings run kind of along the lines of Iman Valda was the blade master, and he was the better blade master, but Galad was the better fighter. Because if you think about it, Iman Valda, just in my own opinion and read of him, he doesn't seem to me like one who can comprehend and especially can't use the oneness or the Kodi or whatever you want to call it, flame in the void. It sounds to me like he's someone who's just too emotional, too overwrought, to be able to feed basically all of himself into this flame and become just reaction. But Galad does. That's something he's learned and something he's used over and over and over again. And I think, in my mind, that is a big part of the reason why he came out on top there. And I don't know if that's significant at all, but it just feels to me like that's one of the major factors in that battle.
Maybe the trial by the light just results in the one that's favored by the light having been the most prepared by the light at some point in time.
It was interesting, Spencer, that you mentioned the various things that we call that state in which the balanced warrior envelops himself. I found it really interesting that during this passage, Galad's teacher is said to have used the phrase the oneness. And the only other person we've ever seen in the series use that phrase was Lanfear, which was kind of odd to me, because when we went back into New Spring, Lan and his teacher, Bukama, and I assume a fair number of men both in the the Blasted Lands, darn it. A number of men in the Borderlands, as well as some of the warders, probably used the term Kodi, which is the modern term for what that state is, up until we get Rand's Flame and Void in Eye of the World. And I just thought it was an interesting choice, because it just seemed a little out of place that out of nowhere we get this one phrase back that kind of didn't seem to fit with the warrior tradition. The oneness sounds more like a channeling thing than it does a state of mind in which a swordsman would enter. It might be me reading into things. I just thought it was an interesting little tidbit there.
I kind of come down on the side of the oneness just being a local phrase that some people use. I mean, Tam used the flame in the void. Mon and Pama call it the Kodi. A lot of people call it the Kodi. But the oneness is really a pretty good description of it, because if you remember, all these swordsmen, when they get ready to fight, the first thing that you hear in their point of view is that they have become one with their surroundings, one with the blade, one with everything that's in their vicinity. They can hear a fly buzzing on the wall. They can smell things more strongly. So I think the oneness is just a really apt description, and maybe it's just a local cultural thing as to who uses which phrase, for whatever reason they might do it. But I don't know if that would be reading too much into it, but it is kind of coincidental, and I'm not going to rule out, RJ having been cunning enough to throw something in there. But since Galad's teachers are both dead, if they were dark friends or, hidden forsaken, what point is it now?
Good point, yeah. Oh, I wasn't implying that, anything about, hidden forsaken or hidden dark friends. It was just one of those things that it seemed a little out of place, but when you described it, the way you described it just now really seems to me to make a lot of sense. The concept of being one with everything would lead to the natural name, the oneness. So I can concede that point now with apt humility.
And they refer to that so many times, it's almost like, RJ's typical description of, here there's a Kandori merchant, there's a Domani, blah, blah, blah. It's like every time you go into a town, that's what you see. And every time you get a swordsman getting ready to fight, they start thinking about how they're at one with everything surrounding them. So I guess it kind of fits. I don't know. I think it's great. I love it. I think it's one of the few real connections to anything that we have in our world and time, where people also call it the oneness in meditation and so forth and so on. It's kind of an interesting link that doesn't happen as often as I might expect.
Yeah. Another thing about this scene, I was not lost on a small bit of irony, in that one of the first things we hear about Galad is that man will always do what is right, regardless of who he hurts, regardless of the consequences. And in doing the right thing and getting justice for Morghese by killing Valda, Galad manages to cause a civil war amongst the Children of the Light.
I don't know if it's actually going to turn into a civil war. I mean, Aswana, the High Inquisitor, is going now to gather the other Lord Commanders, Lord Captains, to try and turn them against him. But I think that at the point when they're actually going to be at each other's throats or whatever, I think if ever Galad or someone else can tell them what actually happened, the battle that happened, Valda agreed to it and all this, I think that they will, most of them, are still good enough people that they will uphold the laws that have been written. Maybe not the Inquisitors, but the Questioners, but I don't know.
It kind of reminds me of when Ishamael is talking about how Rand was guided from the beginning, to cause certain things. His parents were brought together, in order to cause his birth on Dragonmount. They said that his father was led to the job like a stallion, led to his chore, and all sorts of things. And Rand reflects on all the things that had happened that had to happen just that way in order for him to be who he was and where he was. And it almost makes me think that, not that I necessarily think that Galad is Tavirin, which you mentioned the possibility of in our next point, but, and I just argued against their taking a direct hand, but it seems like the wheel does weave certain people into positions to make these key events happen, and it really seems like what's happened with Galad here in order to shake up the Children of the Light and cause all these other things down the road to occur. I mean, just that one incident of Valda deciding to do what he did with Morghese has now branched off, and now we've got different sects, basically, sections of the Children of the Light off on different missions, and maybe it's just a sign of the dissolution of the times, but it's really quite remarkable when you think about how one one little act that one person makes can change basically the course of history.
Oh, yeah. As stated, I found it really interesting that Gala has a bare base few sentences. Hold on just a second. Stupid book.
Well, I'm actually starting to rethink my thought that my stance on Galad being Viren. When I first sat down to read your notes, I thought, no. But the more we talk about it, the more I'm starting to wonder if he's not a minor to Viren on his own.
I'm pretty sure, just from my memory of things that I've heard that RJ has said, so it's really down the grapevine a bit, but I'm pretty sure that he said that really there's only the three Taverin, but everyone else is so caught up in their web. If you think about it, everyone that's important in the books are people that they came in very close contact with in the first book during the time when they were really starting to influence the pattern. I don't know if that's when they were just starting to become Taverin or if that's when they actually when they were starting to have a major influence. But it seems to me like those were the people right then when the three boys were becoming known to the world during the first couple of books. That was when they were at their strongest pull. And if you think about it, kind of like a magnet in paperclips. They pick up the others and then others and then others. So they become these magnetic, these forces that they really aren't, but they're kind of channeling this force through them.
That's really interesting. I hadn't really looked at it quite that way. I like that. But I'm trying to remember, did not RJ say that there were no more Taverin among the major characters, but that he had not ruled out that there were not some among the more minor characters? I consider Galad to be an important character, but I don't consider him to be a major character.
Yeah, like I said, that's just my memory of something that someone said RJ had said, so you could be more correct than I am. In fact, you probably are. It's been too long since I've read actual words from the creator's mouth, as it were, so I don't know. And I'm not even sure where to go and look that up, so.
I don't either. I don't remember where that was said or whatever. There's just some mind about that. It might have been, didn't maybe Jason bring it up in his interview with us?
I don't recall him saying anything about Taverin at all, let alone others that we haven't really seen come into play yet, but I don't know.
Yeah, I do like the theory, though, of being Taverin by association, kind of like that idea that, you know, the larger force sets off smaller forces within a particular boundary, and it very well could happen. I mean, Rand and Galad are, after all, half-brothers as well, so who knows, there could actually be a momentary sort of inheritance that way. But it seemed amazing to me that the Children of the Light have been hating Aes Sedai for thousands of years, and, you know, with a simple phrase like, if you intend to be at Tarmon Gaiden, then you'll have to fight along Aes Sedai from Galad, you know, introduces, you know, all these people to be, well, I don't really hold with the witches any more than most men, but, well, I'm going to be at Tarmon Gaiden, and yeah, I'll fight with the Aes Sedai, sure. And it just seemed like everybody just kind of hopped on board. There wasn't really anyone dissenting at all, and it just seemed like one of those things where, you know, they talk about Arthur Hawkwing either playing cards or tossing dice or flipping a coin or something, and that it always went his way regardless. And it just seems like Galad's mentality that the Aes Sedai aren't evil just seemed to kind of rapidly infect everyone who was around him in almost a kind of I am Spartacus scene. And that just, you know, that's kind of where that idea came from. Now, like I said, I might be totally wrong about that, and it might just be that Galad is just that good.
I don't know. And not only did the White Cloaks agree to fight along the Aes Sedai, but the Ashaman as well. It's like, oh my goodness, this just overturned every core belief that the whole organization ever had in one or two sentences. Now, that is really a Taverin sort of scene when you really get down to it. So I didn't think so originally when we started this talk, but the more I'm thinking about this, the more I'm going to come down on the side that Galad actually might be a Taviran. I don't consider him to be a major character, so he might be. I don't know if there's any genetic inheritance involved in it, or just the wheel and the pattern pick out people in certain key positions and make them Taviran for a time. But I also was kind of intrigued with your notion that the quality of being Taviran can be passed along by association. It sounds like Padden Fane's Shatter Logoth taint from Eridol. You know, you spend too much time with him and you become tainted. I don't know. I guess you can become tainted by the light as quickly as by evil. I don't know, but that's an interesting concept to me.
I don't think it's really called tainting if it's of the light.
Well,
but
no.
Just to kind of play a white here for a second, the logical argument against that is that most of the children who were around him were kind of younger and not as set in their ways. I think at this point the children had been incredibly decimated. The ones who were older of the older generation were either dead or they were the Lord's captain who were gone at the time. But that's just a logical argument. In all reality, I really do agree with the Taviran possibility, whether if it's by association with the three, or whether he himself is a minor Taviran, I don't know. But it really is, I think, more likely to happen in the RJ novel than the logical possibility.
And he really hasn't had that much contact with any of the Taviran. You know, he had a little contact with Rand and a little bit with Matt, none with Perrin, and they were very brief. I mean, Matt was in the White Tower for such a short time when Galad was training there. And as far as I know, his exposure to Rand was limited to the scene where Rand fell into the garden in the palace at Camelon. So that's a really short period of time to last, you know, a lasting effect for that long. But then I know nothing of the ways of Taviran, and if it can be passed along by association, maybe that's enough.
Well, if you think about it, the same shortened time happened with Morghese and Talanvor. I think, in my mind, if you look at the pattern as a whole, then the space that's between people isn't actually influenced by the physical space that they are from each other in Randland. It's more how close or far apart they are in the weavings of the pattern. And I think a relationship like the blood relationship that Galad and Rand have, and even the secondary relationship between Rand and Elaine and Elaine and Galad, I think that can have a major influence on these characters, but that's just my own personal opinion.
Well, there's a lot of merit to it. I like it.
Yeah. The final thing I wanted to bring up about about Galad and the scene with the Children of the Light is this. During that scene where everybody is joining under the new Lord Captain Commander Galad, someone makes a quote. And it is said, in order to fight the raven, you may make alliance with the serpent until the battle is done. And I just have to say this. Amongst the Children of the Light, who would ever have said that? Ever?
Yeah, I believe that was a quote from The Way of the Light by Lothair Mantellar, who was the founder of the Children of the Light. And that book is quoted a couple of times when Galad is reading it in the gardens at Tar Valon when Galad and Min encounter him, and Min insists, you know, she's playing, you know, the curly-haired light skirt Elmindrida, you know, and she says, oh, do sit down and finish your book. I would just feel terrible if you were to stop reading because of me, sort of thing. And then, again, there's a scene in the forest where Valdo has been on Radamasanawa or Asunoa, and he's reading Lothar Mantellar's book, which is usually a book that's given to the absolute, you know, new children. And then they're even taught to read and so that they can read Mantellar's words. And I'm pretty sure that quote came from him, which just goes to show really how far the Pre children have come from the precepts of the original Children of the Light.
Okay, two comments on that one. My first one is, what is the possibility that Asanoa has been replaced by one of the Forsaken?
Well, we know it's not Demandred, because RJ said that Demandred is not masquerading anybody whom we have yet met.
And, you know, Demandred and Moradin are really the only male Forsaken left, so unless one of the females is masquerading, then...
Well, they could be. We don't yet know who's playing Grendel's game and masquerading as somebody else. It could be... You almost say, I think any of the women could masquerade as a man if they weren't having to do it for very long. If they can change their entire appearance to look like anybody and hide behind, you know, masks of flame and facades of shadow and silvery light like Masana and Semiragla, then I think I'd pretty much make themselves appear to anybody who wasn't another Forsaken.
And we know that the Mask of Mirrors is a whole lot easier to maintain if it's similar to the way that the channeler actually looks, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible for them to change what their gender is.
Clearly, the more powerful the channeler, the easier it is for them to maintain a mask that is not what they look, because, you know, the classic cases of Lanfear making herself look Kylie Shiogi in the waist, you know, like she's like 300 pounds and ugly, and then, of course, it's in Teleron Riyadh, but she made herself look like Sylvie, but well, that was in Teleron Riyadh, but clearly some of the more powerful Forsaken could make themselves easily look like anybody. And I remember when Samael and Rendal visited the Aiel, Samael, who had made himself look really different, really tall and very different, he was worried about being touched, but Rendal, who really didn't look that much like her normal thing either, but I guess it wasn't as far off as Samael's, she wasn't afraid to be touched. It's kind of weird.
Even an illusion you should be able to pass your hand through, but I don't know. Anyway, and the second comment that I wanted to make on that is, I'm not entirely sure how all the gifts work, or especially among the men, but is there a possibility that this man who wrote The Way of the Light, Lothair Mantellar, is there a possibility that he could have had the gift of foretelling?
Well, unless he could channel, I don't know how.
But I guess more my question is, would it be possible for him to have the gift of foretelling if he had the spark or the ability to channel but didn't do it? I'm not sure if he would have the mental fortitude to have the ability and not channel, especially to not go mad, but I don't know if it's possible for one to have the ability to channel and so have one of the gifts, specifically the gift of foretelling. But how is their gift related to the amount of power that they use?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, some of the talents don't seem to use the one power at all. I mean, Elida is almost never channeling when we see her suddenly get grabbed by a foretelling. And we know Nicola has had a few here and there, and the only instances that I can remember were when there was either duress or channeling happening around her, so I can't say for sure. But the other thing I was going to say about that is that there are other ways as well to see what's going to happen in the future. There are things like the Wolf Brothers and being a dreamwalker, which has absolutely nothing to do with channeling at all.
And men. Don't forget men. Who's to say men's talent is unique among all men and women?
Well, hers seems more to be related to people who are living and seeing what their future will be. But, yeah, I didn't even think about dreamers and Wolf Brothers. But I guess it seems to me just the way that phrase is written, especially if it was written by Lothair, that it was written by someone who could see into the future, who could see these circumstances and knew that eventually they were going to have to fight with the snakes against the ravens, quite literally.
I think that would almost come under the classification of a prophecy, and there's nothing in the books to tell us that all of the prophecies of the dragon and the dark prophecies and the ones, you know, among the sea folk and everything else, there's nothing to tell us that those are only handed down by channelers. So presumably the gift of prophecy, you know, can land on anybody. So perhaps Lothair Mantellar did have some sense of prophecy or the foretelling. There's nothing also to say that the ability to foretell is strictly limited to channelers. It's just that it's evidently more common in channelers, or they consider it to be one of the major talents.
Or they consider dreaming to be a major talent too, and we know that that has nothing to do with the ability to channel. So
exactly.
I think the Aes Sedai knowledge is sadly incomplete, and they won't acknowledge the fact.
Well, don't get me started on that. That's one of my favorite rants, is how after the breaking, all of a sudden, all of the channelers just forgot how to do all these weaves. I mean, I don't care how discombobulated the world was and what turmoil there was. I can't imagine that nobody would have remembered how to do a weave that they'd been doing all their life and passed it on to somebody else. That would seem to me to be the first thing that you would try to make sure survived you if you, it was a chance that you would be killed by, you know, either insane male channelers or the brain of the world itself or whatever, but whatever, that's what happened. I just woke up one morning and I forgot. It happens to me all the time.
Either that or they were too arrogant and knew that they would, oh, it's okay, we'll get this to rights. And then they died, and all the people left didn't have the power or the ability to cast all these weeds, and so, you know, they didn't need to know how to do it, and so they didn't.
It reminds me of that scene in Lara Croft Tomb Raider where the castle is all, you know, destroyed by all these people looking for the objects that she's got and everything, and this UPS man comes up, and he's kind of looking around at the devastation, and she looks at him, and she says, I just woke up this morning and hated everything. Well, that's what the Aes Sedai did. They just woke up one morning and said, I don't want to remember that anymore. I'm never going to do that again.
No. How used could traveling ever be to anybody? I mean, come on, the world only doesn't exist anymore as we once knew it.
Yeah, where's there to travel to? Everything is devastation. Let's just forget about it.
So, the healing that Nynaeve does, was that the same as the healing they used in the Age of Legends, or similar? Or did they also have this really kind of rough healing that all the Aes Sedai seem to know?
I think Nynaeve's is probably closer to the Age of Legends, although, well, until recently when she was able to teach it to everybody else, I had some serious wonderings about Nynaeve's healing ability because it seemed too similar to the healing that was done by the True Power, and I can't imagine that Nynaeve is tapping into the True Power, but since she's able to teach her new, quote-unquote, form of healing to other channelers, it probably is just a matter of using all the weaves and all the flows, you know, earth, fire, water, all of them, instead of just, you know, air and water as the Aes Sedai have been using since the breaking. And I suspect she just rediscovered what they knew back in the Age of Legends, my guess anyway. I don't know.
I know it's the first, and isn't the only example we have of the true power being used to heal in the prologue to the Eye of the World? And we know that that was practically paramount to torture on Luz Theron.
Well, he said he was never very good at it either.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, now that I've led us sufficiently off topic, shall we digress?
Well, you're just becoming part of the crew here. That's part of our initiation. You have to be able to lead us successfully off topic at least once during an episode.
So, moving on towards our next section of the prologue, this being the one dealing with Rodel Itralda, one of the interesting things that he makes mention of during the thoughts is that the Seanchan aren't just invading. We know from previous books that they brought in, you know, farmers and all this sort of things, but it's not just that they're, you know, the Seanchan are coming in and they're displacing the people who are already here and taking over their farms and settlements. The Seanchan are industrializing. They're building farms. They're building villages, and you know they're. It seems to me like they're kind of reinfusing the land, which, when you really look at it, is quite empty with extra people and more civilization. So I just found that a really interesting point.
I don't think that they're actually displacing anybody. They seem to be going out of their way to build, as you said, new farms and new villages. And, you know, the bannermen, outside of Valanuka's show, when they have with the three Seanchan, and she says, you know, we're supposed to be doing the work, you know, and doing all this stuff so that the home folks don't feel like we're trying to, you know, be better than them or whatever. They seem to be going out of their way to try and make themselves not really fit in, but, I mean, it's mentioned several times that they're basically benevolent rulers. They take over a city, they do as little damage as they can, they fix it all right away, they open up soup kitchens for the poor, they put everybody to work, they get crews out cleaning the canals and all this other stuff. They seem like they're, you know, fairly benign as far as invaders go. So I don't see them displacing people.
That's one of my favorite arguments to get into with people, and you might remember this, Virginia. But in my estimation, the government, the control and the structure, especially the infrastructure that the Seanchan bring, is preferable to pretty much anything else that we see in Randland at the time. People have their position, they do what they're supposed to do, and everything runs much smoother. There's a major decrease in the amount of poor. The slums are cleaned up and out, or out and up. And they're no longer places where people fear to go, where they come surrounded by seven hired toughs. The Seanchan bring organization, they bring order to the chaos that just happens when people get together and form citizenries. They form countries and communities. There will always be those who are, especially when you get into big cities, there usually are people who are poor. There are people who think to do harm for gain, but that number seems to be drastically less than among the Seanchan than it is among the rest of the Randland empires. In my estimation, except for their preponderance for chaining channelers, the Seanchan are the best rulers in the entire world as we know it. Maybe with the exception of the sea folk, but they're far too arrogant for me.
No, I do agree that the Seanchan haven't displaced people. They've gone out of their way to do so. I just, for some reason, to me, it seems counter to the concept of an invasion that, you know, you would do that sort of thing and then, like, suddenly pass into this area and start, you know, setting up your own space. And the industrialization of the places that they are coming into seems to actually, in my mind, be a really good thing for the continent as a whole.
Well, except for the fact that the other side of the coin, all the order and organization that they bring with them, also is such a tightly structured society that there really is a lot of loss of personal freedom and liberty. And if upward mobility, if you will, they're big believers in everybody in their place, you know, and that's their place and they should stay in it. You know, we heard about that from the Seanchan and the traveling show. You know, Sarandon says that, you know, that Elaine, who is going under another name, should basically, you know, stay in her place and not try to rise above it and not try to go around telling people that she was nobly born and all this sort of stuff. That she should be pleased to be a talented high walker and that perhaps she could perform in front of the Empress one day and perhaps some lord would take her as his Asaw, you know, which I guess is like a concubine or something, and they can have honored positions too. But I mean, it's really very tightly structured. There's just not a lot of upward mobility. So you trade that, you know, in our histories as well as in Randland, I think you trade that for the benefits of a tightly structured, organized society. There's basically a caste system there, and it's difficult, I think, for people to break out of it, unless they're in the military and perform some huge act of heroism or, you know, something extraordinary happens. People live and die. If they're weavers, they're weavers for the rest of their lives. If they're, you know, laborers, they're laborers for the rest of their lives. If they become Dako Vale, they're Dako Vale for generation after generation. That doesn't change.
True. And also with the Seanchan, there is a drastic amount of cultural assimilation. I mean, in order to adopt the Seanchan as rulers, you kind of do have to end up adopting their culture as well. Otherwise, you can't fit into their society if you're not following the way they work with themselves.
That's very true. That's another of the major problems with the Seanchan is they have their structure and they have their culture and they are not about to bend to any other culture, which is part of the reason why people won't accept them, why people are fighting against them, but it's another part of the thing that makes them really strong is that they aren't going to bend, they aren't going to break. When you look at the cultures of our world, and of our world especially, I'm thinking of, when they start to assimilate other cultures and then bend to that culture, eventually they bend so far that they break, and then neither culture really exists, and you're left with some shattered remains of a civilization. To kind of argue your point, Virginia, sure, there's not a lot of upward movement among the Seanchan, but if you think about it, really there's not a lot of upward movement anywhere else. Farmers, if they want to, they can work hard, they can apply themselves to become something a little bit better, but not much. Really, the people coming out of the Two Rivers are an extreme of that. They're not the rule, they are the exception to that. The rest of the people in the Two Rivers for generations upon generations upon generations were in their place, and that was the niche they filled, and they were perfectly fine to fill that niche. It's not until something major comes along, like an Aes Sedai coming to town, that they start to look above themselves and say, you know, I can't reach that, and I'm going to.
Well, I disagree. I think there's a certain tendency for inertia among families and people as well as anything else. And certainly if you grow up in a small village and your father was a farmer and a sheep herder, then you're probably going to be a farmer and a sheep herder too. But there are always cases, not just in the Two Rivers, of people going off and doing other things and making their own way. I mean, they're not told by a, you know, patrol or a committee that they have to stay as a farmer. They can run off to the city and become a potter or a weaver or anything they choose. They can run off and join the military like Tam did and rise to be, you know, one of the, you know, first captain of the companions and all this sort of thing. It's just not that easy among the Xiangchen. They go around and they visit the villages and they pick out the people that are going to be trained in military or whatever. You remember Ferret Kareed was proud that he was chosen to become one of the Death Watch guards and start training for that. You know, otherwise he would have been stayed the son of a weaver probably forever and ever. I mean, it's just, they have a different way of doing things. I'm not saying it's, you know, necessarily right or wrong. It's just very different. And I think it's much more difficult in a culture like the Xiangchen culture or like some of our, you know, heavily caste-oriented cultures in our world to break out of the mold and make even a sideways movement, let alone an upward mobility type of movement. And I think what Robert Jordan with the Xiangchen was really fascinating. You know, they started out being the biggest villains in the world. You know, you thought these were going to be the ultimate heavies. And the more you get to know them, it's sort of like a Gwyn's journey. The more you get to know them, the more you like them, or Nynaeve, the same. You know, they're actually not so bad. But on the one hand, they have many, many good characteristics to their culture and civilization. But they have many really heinous ones, too. They keep slaves. You know, they're conquerors. I mean, they do a lot of really bad things. So in that way, I suppose they're not much different from any other culture.
That's very true. Every culture has its dark underside, the things that are not good and should not be accepted. It's not a utopian society by any stretch of the imagination. But to me, the good in it outweighs most of the bad. The only breaking points I have with them is the slave Damani trade.
A few more things with Rodel's point of view. This is one of the first instances in the books that we see the dead walking. As a matter of fact, the first time I read through the book, it didn't even occur to me that that's what it was. You know, I kind of carte blanche accepted Rodel's thinking that, well, maybe the villagers came in and drug the bodies off really quickly or something like that. And, you know, it didn't even occur to me that the reason the people were just kind of lazily walking through the streets is that they were dead and they didn't really care that, you know, there were horses charging through them. So it was just one of those interesting things that I noted on this time through that I just had never noticed before. It was like, oh, those people are dead. I get it now.
Yeah, when I read it just in preparation for this a couple days ago, I honestly didn't even think about the dead walking. I assumed that it was some illusion from the Damani, probably to inspire fear in those they were charging. Look, we're not afraid to charge down our own villagers. We're not going to be afraid to take whatever means necessary to slaughter you. I guess I'm one of those lower people that don't catch on to everything.
Oh, I think I've read through some of these books, especially some of the earlier ones, at least 10 times. I know I'm on my at least 10th reread of the earlier ones, and I'm certainly on probably 6 on Knife of Dreams, and I don't always catch things the first time I go back, and I go, now, how did I miss that? Huh? You know, I always love this phrase that you come up with next in your notes, Andrew, that I believe it's Rodala Teralda that says this, and he's always planned for every eventuality he could imagine, short of the Dragon Reborn himself suddenly appearing in front of him. Yeah, no foreshadowing there, huh?
Yeah, I know. Gee, where is Rand by the end of Knife of Dreams? It's so hard to put my finger on it.
You know what else? Talking about things that just escaped me, I totally missed it. It just jumped out at me. It's like one sentence long. We know that Rand has ordered the Aiel to leave Caimlan. But all of a sudden I read through this, and there's one little sentence saying that that Rand's thinking about in his point of view when he's dealing with all the people in Tyr and so forth. You know, Avienda is with the Aiel in Ar-a-Dhoman. I went, duh, I never caught on all this time that he sent the Aiel to Ar-a-Dhoman, where he's sending newly crowned King Darlan. I don't know how I missed that, but I did every single time up until yesterday.
Yeah, it's amazing sometimes what ends up sticking out at you. The only other point I really had, and it's a kind of minor point possibly, with Rodel, is that the leader of the Dragonsworn Terabiners, the man they call Lanassier, he appears, we kind of meet him, they characterize him as kind of being a hothead, and, you know, unlikely to come to his senses when he's chasing after the fleeing Seanchan. And it kind of caught to me, why did we characterize him and make such a big deal out of him if we completely lose him and we never see him again? It just seems like one of those things that now I'm expecting him to show up somewhere else. And it just seems really kind of, I don't know. It was that idea that RJ never created a named character that he used without a specific reason, and just the fact that we get this guy and lose him so quickly seems really out of place for RJ.
Yeah, that goes back to my favorite phrase that I haven't actually trotted out in a while, that Robert Jordan didn't put anything in these books by chance. Every single thing means something. It's scary, but yeah. He probably is going to pop up somewhere. Because he didn't die. He just raced off into the sunset. So, you know, he could show up again. We don't know.
He definitely has all the earmarks of one of the disciples of the Prophet of the Dragon. And all these people are insane in the extreme, and bloodthirsty, disgusting cretins. But it kind of sounds to me just... It seems to me like, with the problems that they're having in Terrabond, especially with Soros' reaction to this, and now we know at the end of the Knife of Dreams, Tuon comes into power. I don't know what they've done to mend Terrabond in the interim, but it kind of seems to me like he might turn out to be one of the major sticking points between Rand and Tuon and their negotiations for peace, because they call themselves Dragonsworn. They believe that they've sworn allegiance to the Dragon Reborn. No matter what he does or does not think about it, and I guarantee you, he is as far gone as Rand is, he's not one who would at all condone these kind of actions. But they still believe that he's leading them and that they're doing things that he would want them to do. And I think that that could turn out to be a huge problem in negotiations with the Seanchan. Without Matt there, I'm not sure that anything at all can happen between those two groups.
Well, I just got to throw in here, wow, way to trash the Terrabonners, Spencer. Hey, you might be
just the Dragonsworn, not the Terrabonners.
You might be bloodthirsty too if somebody took over your whole country.
I was talking specifically about the Dragonsworn. I wasn't trying to trash the Terrabonners, although they do have some pretty odd clothing styles that I'm not sure I agree with. They're not quite as bad as Damani dresses, though.
Okay. The sticking point for me is those mustaches and the chainmail veils. That just is not going to work. Sorry, nobody who wrote that has ever had that kind of facial hair and a chain link veil.
I imagine there's a piece of cloth shielding between the actual chainmail and the facial hair. That is just my initial guess.
Doesn't say that.
If you're looking at it from the outside, all you see is chainmail.
Okay.
It could just be that they give themselves over to the pain of having their mustache hairs ripped out over and over and over and over again.
Oh, like Egwene, embrace the flames, embrace the pain, soak in the pain. Oh.
Because of the length of this podcast, we've decided to split it into two parts. So this is your intermission. Thank you.